Maybe you like a drink now and then. Maybe you like one every night and every day. When do you cross the line between doing something that gives you pleasure into a zone where you have to do that thing? That and many other questions are considered in a book about addiction and recovery, a book that goes a bit against the medical grain in its approach to recovery. The book is The Addiction Spectrum, A Compassionate, Holistic Approach to Recovery. It is the work of Paul Thomas, MD, and Jennifer Margulis, PhD. Paul Thomas is board certified in pediatrics and addiction medicine. He practices at Integrative Pediatrics in Portland and addiction medicine practice, an addiction medicine practice called Fair Start. Jennifer Margulis, you probably have heard more often. She's a science journalist with a number of books and articles to her credit, including work published in major newspapers and Smithsonian. She's also an occasional contributor to JPR News. This is their second joint visit with us. They joined us in September 2016 to talk about a previous book, The Vaccine Friendly Plan. So, Dr. Paul Thomas, don't see you as often. Good to see you in the studio.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and it's good to be here.
Jennifer Margulis, always see you around a little more often, but nice to see you in this room for the first time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the book in general. I mean, what needed to be said in this book hadn't been said before, did you feel, Paul Thomas?
Well, I want to clarify, I'm not against the medical establishment in this book. I think we are bringing to the public a whole new approach to do alongside whatever you're doing with your current doctor. So I don't want you to feel like, oh, I've got to throw out whatever I'm doing. But I'm pretty sure you're going to learn a lot of new things that will help your overall health.
So it's a compliment, not a replacement.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
All right. So you address the addiction crisis in your first sentence. I mean, what do people miss by focusing on the particular drug, like opioids now or crack cocaine in the past? I was going to say meth in the past, but that appears to be on the upswing as well right now.
It's still with us, sure. Well, addiction is live and well, as everybody knows. If you're watching the news, you're reading things like 72,000 overdoses in 2017, up from 63,000 in 2016. Sorry, the first number was 17 and then 16. And just this past year, 30,000 of those were from fentanyl, which is this new, very strong opioid drug that basically it's like an elephant tranquilizer and so powerful that if you inject that, if you're a heroin user, for example, you're dead in minutes.
It killed both Prince and Tom Petty, right?
I believe that's correct, mm-hmm. Yeah. So really hard stuff.
Jennifer Margulis, I can always appreciate the parts of the book where I think your grasp is the firmest, because it's when you really start to delve into some of the enormity. I mean, Dr. Paul Thomas deals with a lot of patients on a one-on-one basis, but it looks like you're able to pull in a lot of information about the breadth of addiction. It affects a lot of people, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, like Dr. Thomas was just saying, we're seeing more and more addiction. So you started off by asking, like, when does a drink every night become a problem? When does a problem become an addiction? And one of the things we talk about in this book, it's a concept that we introduce, is that addiction happens on a spectrum. And so we see addiction from mild, moderate to severe. And we have to answer the question, why so many more and why now? Why are we seeing so many more people becoming addicted to opioids, which is the issue that's in the news all of the time? And then we also have the question of screen addiction, which is something that parents and Dr. Thomas's practice talk about all the time, concerns that their children are just getting obsessed with being on screens. So, you know, in the past, we've always said that there are addicts and non-addicts and that there's a total black line between them and that there's sort of nothing in between. You either are addicted or you aren't. And we want to question that concept and ask the question, like we say, actually, that, you know, that everyone has the potential to fall somewhere on the addiction spectrum.
And you look at a number of factors, both within and without, and based on the research you've done separately and together, I mean, is it just that there are more things to be addicted to now, or are there more things that stress us in society that lead us to explore those addictions?
That's such a good question, and I want to turn it back to Dr. Thomas before I tell. I mean, I could talk about that for the next hour, but
So stresses are absolutely key. Right. Let me tell briefly so the listeners can get a picture of my own story. So I was a missionary kid in Africa. I grew up in a village.
Born in Oregon, though, right?
Born in Portland, Oregon, actually. And at age four, my parents became missionaries, went to Rhodesia. That's Zimbabwe today. And I say the perfect childhood. It really was an amazing childhood of just living in a village, running free, eating vegetables out in the sunshine, getting tons of exercise. You know, we talk about your biome, which is your internal diversity of your GI tract. I mean, I sure had it. We were swimming in ponds that were, I'm sure, infested with everything known to man. Went to high school on a mountain in Swaziland. I basically had zero exposure to drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, almost no stress other than going off to boarding school, but it was an honor in those days because the best students got to do that. So I waltzed through the entire childhood without real any huge risk factors that move you along the addiction spectrum. So let's fast forward to I'm in college, I discover beer, I'm isolated from my support system, which is still in Africa, and I loved the effect. So this was one thing. Alcohol for me was meeting a need. Had I been somewhere in middle America where opioids were the thing and more available, I have no doubt that's where I would have ended up. I also started smoking cigarettes just for that short little relief that would provide. And what became clear to me as I look back on it is that I had this predisposition to loving the effect that these things were producing. And what made me vulnerable was some genetic factors. I carry, people who might know about this, I have the MTHFR defect, I have the COMT defect. So I was predisposed, perhaps more than, say, my co-author Jennifer, who we would call a normie. She can take a sip of wine and then just leave it at the table. That made no sense to me. I mean, I was going to finish mine and hers, you know, if I was back in my drinking days. And so there are huge environmental factors that make us more vulnerable. And I think today, how disconnected kids are is a huge factor that's sort of predisposing them. At some point, I want to share a couple stories from my practice that'll really highlight that.
Okay, I definitely want to get to those. We were talking about the addiction spectrum, a compassionate, holistic approach to recovery with the co-authors Paul Thomas, a medical doctor, and Jennifer Margulis, a longtime journalist. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Jennifer is gesticulating wildly.
No, I just wanted to go back to this question about, is there more stress? What's going on? Why are we seeing such a rise, right? And so one of the things is that children have access to drugs and alcohol. That's one thing that Dr. Thomas was talking about, especially to drugs. And we see that here in Ashland, Oregon, which is kind of the dirty secret of our town. A lot of children are actually getting drugs from their parents' medicine chests. And, you know, I ran into a guidance counselor who was at the hospital because a kid had to get his stomach pumped. That wasn't something that got into the news because people don't want to talk about it. There's a shame factor. But the mom bar that he made, which was methamphetamines, marijuana, and opioids, mom.
MOM.
Yeah. You know, he was getting from his parents. So access is one thing. The huge amount of stress that we're all feeling in our culture right now, partly because we're feeling disconnected, partly because we're on phones too much. And then these lifestyle factors, Jeffrey. People aren't going outside. They're vitamin D deficient. They're not getting the kind of exercise that they need to get. They're not eating whole, healthy foods. And so all of these things are kind of pushing the humans who are naturally might be inclined to come addicted to feel despair and depressed and anxious, and then they turn to drugs and alcohol to self-medicate, if that makes sense.
Well, and in fact, in the book, you describe this as a perfect addiction storm. So all these factors coming together create opportunity and desire.
Absolutely. And then there's one more thing, which is something that we talk about quite a bit in the book, which is that there is actually a concerted effort. It's fair to say it this way, and if you want the details, they're all in the addiction spectrum, but there is a concerted effort on the part of the pharmaceutical industry, which I know you've talked about before on this show, and the big food and big alcohol, concerted effort to push us towards addiction, because the more addicted we are, the more we use a substance, the more money a lot of people make. So actually, we know that the tech industry is trying to get you addicted to your phone and making huge amounts of money doing so. That kind of thing is a systematic problem that we have that we want to counter by raising people's awareness about the problems.
Is it being stated a little too archly, though? I ask this because, I mean, of course, any company wants you to buy their product over and over again. Ford wants you to buy a new Focus at least every 5 years, I would think. But were you into a zone here where you're talking about like Apple and similar companies want you to have to use those things?
Well, it's funny because that's something that that's actually come out in the media in the last few years, and now they're turning away from it. The new operating system, as you know, on the phone actually gives you ways to counter too much screen time, right? And part of the reason why these companies are stepping up to do that is because they actually were studying how to get people to look at their phones more, and they're doing a fabulous job. I don't know about you, but I find it hard to put my phone down.
Yeah, it has that effect on us for sure. So this brings us to an old line, and I went looking actually to see what the source of it was and was unable to find it, that says if you want to get people off drugs, you make reality better. there are suggestions in the book to that end too, or are we dealing with just the circumstances in each person's life?
Well, I think we deal with that in the sense of, we mentioned the rat park experiments that Bruce Alexander did in the 80s. And what he did was took rats who were in isolated cages and gave them morphine water and water, and they would drink morphine water often to the point of death. You take that same rat and you put it in a large park-like facility where they have places to hide, mate, play with playmates, and they will preferentially drink the water, avoid the morphine. Even if they're addicted previously to morphine and you put them in that park, they will detox themselves. So I think what we're dealing with in society is just people have become so isolated, almost like that rat in a cage, that they're looking for relief. And it's just a fact of the way our society has evolved. Unlike the village where I grew up, where, I mean, my parents could just let me out the front door, and the entire village was watching all the kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were in a park. We were in a rat park of amazing magnitude. And then you take me and put me in college, and I'm isolated, and now I'm that rat in the cage. And the distress on the organism, in this example, me, was so great that I looked for relief wherever I could find it.
But didn't you essentially move into didn't you move into a new rat park when you went to college?
Perhaps if I was emotionally prepared for that particular environment.
But it was too much separation from your old one?
It was away from all my support systems. And the stress, in my case, there was also the stress of changing academic situations. I was in a British system. The American system was multiple choice. I had never seen a multiple choice exam. Everything was essay. You just wrote about what you knew. I don't know if that had a whole lot to do with it or not, or if it was just my predispositions, but I suspect in retrospect, as I look back on my life, it certainly was a major factor. And when I share some stories from my practice just from this past week, I think you might see what I mean.
Dr. Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. The book they co-wrote is called The Addiction Spectrum, A Compassionate, Holistic Approach to Recovery. We're going to talk about things even like what you eat in addition to how to break addiction through medical means. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Talk about micro factors within a person's life that lead to addiction or the macro factors in society at large. 800-838-3760 if you want to join the conversation by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I've got to make sure I'm looking at the inbox instead of the spam box here. Okay, there we go. So join us on the conversation by all means. There is a caution to non-addicts up front in the book that you probably think this can't happen to you. And you've probably seen more than a few people, including in the mirror, who were in that category.
Sure. So we make the presentation in the book that we're all on the spectrum, you might just be sitting at zero. So if you're a non-addict or what I'd call a normie, for that particular substance, you may have no desire and it may never happen for you. But when you start thinking about other addictions like food, the addiction to the screens that are becoming so pervasive, when you think about the fact that two-thirds of Americans are obese or overweight, there's a clue there that perhaps we do have a challenge in the area of food for most of us, just as one example. But it's also a spectrum, right? I've struggled with the food thing most of my adult life since I came to the United States because in Africa, there was very limited access to food as well. I mean, it was just what was on the table. That was it. I remember my family of six sharing one trout, and my dad would eat the head. I mean, just that was all he got. And I was always felt wanting more. Come to the United States, I go to college and I visited colleges and I judged them on their cafeterias because the food was just so overwhelmingly impressive. Well, of course I started gaining weight and having issues with food. I was attracted to the sugar and the processed foods and as so many are.
So let's describe the spectrum then. You described and you put Jennifer on that end of the spectrum as a normie. What's the other end of the spectrum?
So we'll take alcohol, which is the one I have the most familiarity with personally.
For your own addiction.
My own addiction, one of them. And, you know, I was a non-drinker first, and then I was a binge drinker in college. And then somewhere in the 90s, after medical school, once I'm a doctor, I'm out there, it becomes every day except for the nights I'm on call. And then eventually I even crossed that line to where it was daily. Now, what was happening was I'm progressively moving along the spectrum of severity, you might call it, and I reached that point where what was just an infatuation, a desire, an interest became a compulsion, and then it became such a physical addiction that I would undergo severe withdrawal if I didn't have my substance. So in my case, alcohol, I would get a headache. I would get just sort of a fog. This is more than just the hangover. This is if you, when you're addicted to a substance to the level of a severe end of the spectrum, symptoms of withdrawal become severe. And they're unique based on the substance, right? Opiate withdrawal is different than alcohol withdrawal, is different than meth withdrawal. But when you're having physical withdrawal symptoms, you are now on the towards the severe end of the spectrum. And you end up using your substance of choice at that point just to avoid the symptoms of withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And that's that vicious cycle that, you know, I think, you know, people who are addicted to opiates in particular know so well, because the withdrawal is so intense, almost no one will go through it. They will do whatever it takes to get their hands on some opiates again.
Let's take some phone calls. We're talking to Dr. Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis about their book, The Addiction Spectrum, A Compassionate, Holistic Approach to Recovery. Here's a call from Ellen in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Okay, look, somebody is talking to us, so let's try to listen to us on the radio. Ellen, when you hear this on the radio, stop listening through the car radio and just listen through the phone, because that's how we can put you on. Meanwhile, Shane in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, I just called in because I was listening to the program, and I just wanted to share that I had issues with, you know, anxiety, depression, things like that, and I saw a medical professional who did a genetic testing, and it came back with a COMT marker that showed that my dopamine levels were all out of whack. And once I went on a supplement called SAM-E, I've never felt this good in my life. It's just I would stress anybody that's dealing with any kind of issue like this, reach out, talk to somebody, talk to a medical professional, and seek help, because that's the first step.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Shane. And Paul Thomas can tell us a little more about what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, Shane, thank you for that comment. You thankfully went to a practitioner who knew about genetic testing and what to do with that information. A lot of MDs don't. So for your listeners, if your doctor doesn't know what to do about that, you've got to find a doctor who does. SAM-E is very specific in promoting the conversion of dopamine to norepinephrine, norepinephrine to epinephrine, and opening up those pathways, which when they're blocked, it's just a matter of getting the right nutrients so that you can open those pathways up. And it's what a fantastic story that you're sharing, because I do neurotransmitter testing, genetic testing for those who are willing and can afford it. And in some cases, I mean, I've had young patients who were having hallucinations, and we're seeing a psychiatrist, and we're about to go on lifelong antipsychotics, fix it with just a few supplements. So this is the power of our genetics, the power of our biochemistry, and the importance of knowing exactly what's going on. Thank you for that comment.
Let me see if we can put Ellen on the line now. Ellen in Ashland, welcome to the exchange. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we're fine.
Okay. Thank you guys both for being on. It's amazing you're bringing this. I think that the problem goes a little bit deeper than just these organizations like Monsanto and Big Pharma making money. What they have invested in is the necessity to keep everyone asleep. So while we're all being addicted to everything, we're also trying to get unaddicted. So all the time and all the energy that everybody is spending in doctor's offices, trying to make a living on our gerbil wheels, all of these things we're seeing, you know, in this perfect storm of what we've got right now in the elections, who do we want to choose? Do we want to choose the people who are going to protect the planet and make sure that we're still alive? Or do we want to invest in the, you know, the system that created all of this and continues to create all of this, with the end game being the destruction of the planet, the disempowerment of women, and the division of the different sides.
All right, Ellen, thanks for the call. I want to give a time for a response before we get to a break. We have one coming up here. So Ellen Ashland, thank you. And Jennifer Margulis, this is a lot of your research, I would think.
Well, I'm just appreciating, Ellen, your comments, because Jeffrey was accusing me of being too overstated. So then you said it even stronger. So now I feel vindicated.
No accusation, just a question.
No, I appreciate it. And it's true. And I would like to say that, you know, when I say systematic, you know, we do have some systems problems. And at the same time, a lot of the people who are working within those systems are trying to work for the greater good. I think we all can agree that we don't want to destroy the planet, and we don't want to destroy our children's bodies and their brains, even though that sometimes ends up being the end result of too many toxic exposures and too much addiction and too much emphasis on making money. And Ellen, yes, I agree with you that the future of our children and of our planet are at stake, so we really have to take these things really seriously and fix it.
Is it as bold as she states it, though, that she thinks it's an effort to make sure that we stay addicted, or stay addicted and then having to treat it with other pharmaceuticals, that sort of thing?
You know, I do think that that is an incredibly successful business model. So if somebody is addicted and then you have a drug that you can sell them to help them get off of their addiction, I mean, unlike Shane, who went to a doctor who really found a natural and less money-making way to treat what was wrong with him, I don't think that it's a concerted effort. Nobody goes to work and says, I'm going to destroy the planet. But I do think that when you can find a way to continue making money, you continue on that path.
Jennifer Margulis and Paul Thomas are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. They will come back. You have not missed your opportunity to comment on the addiction spectrum, a compassionate, holistic approach to recovery. We'll come back to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. @8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're online at we're online at jeffexchange.org. I'm moving ahead to the email address. But we are online at jeffexchange.org, where we archive all of our interviews dating back 5 years plus now. And you also can listen live through that link and the parent site of ijpr.org, which gives you access to pretty much everything we're up to at JPR on the radio and on the web. ijpr.org, jeffexchange.org. We are on Facebook. We're on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. And you can take part in the program as it happens. This portion of the exchange is the continuation of our discussion about addiction and treatment for everything from opioid painkillers to screen addiction. One of our guests treats people for addiction, the other researches addiction, the people it affects, and the scope. So we've got a doctor and a journalist. Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis are the co-authors of The Addiction Spectrum, a compassionate, holistic approach to recovery. And yes, you can join us by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I'm guessing that the reason we have Paul Thomas in town is because there's an event coming up this weekend?
That's right.
All right. What is it?
Well, I'm going to let Jennifer describe it, because she's actually hosting and putting this whole event on.
So we've got, it's called the Healthy Immunity Conference. It's Healthy Immunity from Birth to Old Age. And things kick off tonight with a film screening of Why Not Home? The Surprising Choices of Doctors and Nurses, which is a documentary about doctors who choose to do home birth. And then a panel discussion. And one of our panelists is Melissa Cheney, who some listeners might recognize. She's a cultural anthropologist at OSU. And then tomorrow morning, things begin in the Rogue River Room at SOU, and we've got an incredible lineup of speakers. They're all flying here to wonderful Ashland, Oregon, which made me nervous when you were saying that the weather was going to be bad, because I'm sort of wanting to show off our beautiful town.
It's mildly bad.
So we've got a researcher coming from Duke University Medical School. He's an immunologist, and he's going to be talking about some absolutely fascinating new research that he's doing on the microbiome and the biome, the organisms that live in us and on us. We've got one of the founding fathers of functional medicine. And for those people who don't know what functional medicine is, it's what we were talking about at the beginning, integrating Western medicine, the best of modern medicine, with other practices that can help, including, you know, including lifestyle changes and food and avoidance of toxins. So his name is Sydney Baker, and he is literally a hero, kind of in a gentler approach to medicine. He's been practicing for 50 years and had really astonishingly good results. We've got Dr. Thomas is going to be speaking, as am I, Casey Flagel, who is a local chiropractor will be also talking. And then our last speaker is J.B. Hanley, who's a Stanford graduate who wrote a book about autism. And he's going to be talking about the connection between aluminum and autism and Alzheimer's. So we've got an incredible lineup of speakers. And then Saturday night, we're showing a movie called Symbiotic Earth, How Lynn Margulis Rocked the Boat and Started a Scientific Revolution. And that's a movie that's not available publicly yet, but it's about the microbiologist Lynn Margulis and her work on microorganisms and the endosymbiotic hypothesis.
Any relation?
Yes. So Lynn Margulis was my mom. Mm-hmm. She was also married to the astronomer Carl Sagan, which some people who don't know her name certainly know his. The movie is absolutely fascinating, and her work really foreshadows our current interest in bacteria and our current interest in the microbiome and the biome. So I'm really excited about this blend of science and health. And, you know, the whole conference, it's birth to old age, and I encourage anyone who's local to come out and participate.
Okay, that's a big conference. And what time tomorrow start?
So the doors open at 8 o'clock. We're serving a healthy continental breakfast with gluten-free and dairy-free options and vegetables. The people at SOU are astonished that I asked for a vegetable plate, but we believe that you need to seed the healthy bacteria by eating lots and lots of vegetables. But anyway, you were just asking me what time it starts. 8 o'clock, the doors open. The conference starts at 9. 9 to 4 are the speakers, and then the film is screening at 6:30.
Any admission charge for this?
Yes. So it's cheaper if you register online. The conference is $139 for the day online. It's $159 if you come at the door. The film screening is free and open to the public. Anyone who's participating in the conference gets into the film. But we're asking for a $15 donation at the door. And this is all being co-hosted by two nonprofits. So it's a nonprofit conference, and it's Southern Oregon Birth Connections is our local co-host, and they work to support women having choices in childbirth, access to doulas, access to midwives. So the money is all going to a really good cause.
All right, and that's all tomorrow on the Southern Oregon University campus, all focused on the Stevenson Union?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So let's come back to, because that did obviously relates back to some of the stuff we're talking about here in the addiction spectrum. We touched a couple times on genetic factors, because we talked about societal factors and the pressures that can lead people into addiction. But you and one of our callers, Shane, I guess, mentioned the COMT anomaly and MTHFR, I think you said for yourself as well. So there are some genetic components to addiction.
Sure. And, you know, our listeners can understand this. If you have a parent or two parents who were addicts or alcoholics themselves, you've probably heard, and it's true, that your risk goes way up. I think it's at least 50% with one parent and about 80% if both parents were addicts or alcoholics. And that's just sort of general epidemiology. We now have these genetic tests where you can actually drill down and start to realize, oh, these are my genetic markers that put me at risk.
All right. But how do you, I mean, where do you find the line? And I ask this, you know, basically my own family history. My mother went to her grave denying she was an alcoholic, but she never stopped drinking either.
Mm. Right. Well, I think the good news and the message we're trying to share in this book is that there's something you can do about it regardless of your risk factors. So just think of it this way. We are all at risk. Some of us maybe a little more than others, but what do we do? And so what we highlight in this book is the importance of eating real food. That allows you to get your nutrients. We want to avoid toxins, so try to eat organic as much as possible. I know those of you down here in Ashland are better at this than us Portlanders up north. But vitamin D is one of those nutrients you rarely get enough from food, so you might need to supplement that particular nutrient. And then the big X factor is stress. And the biggest stress X factor is those cell phones. And I want to come back to that because I've got some phenomenal stories from my practice. But finishing in these risk factors, that the things you can do something about, get enough sleep. Sleep is restorative to both your immune system and will allow you to be in much more resilient. And then exercise. It helps your biome, it helps your energy, it helps your neurotransmitters, and then finally, your environment. If you have toxic people in your world or if you're isolated, that's a risky environment. So these are all things we highlight often in the book, because even though you think of addiction, oh, I've got to go see a doctor, no, there's a whole lot you can do to build your resilience, build your resistance to moving along the spectrum. And if you find yourself, you're you know, sort of in trouble with an addiction, we want to move you back to the mild end and help you get well.
Let's take another call. And we have Kristen in Cottage Grove on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis, the authors of The Addiction Spectrum. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. So I just wanted to call in. I work in mental health as a therapist, and I work with I've worked with some clients who have been kind of managing addictions that have been hurting them. And it's great because they come in for therapy. Obviously, things aren't working for them. And it's just been really kind of a neat process to see, because often an addiction is fueled by a painful event or unresolved emotional hardship or loneliness. And often I kind of think people in a way have given up, that they're never going to feel right again. And the addiction sort of comes in to sort of reassure or to take the edge off of that. But it's been really cool because there's just some really powerful forms of therapy that work with the right brain and work with how trauma is stored, and kind of helps alleviate the stress felt, you know, in the autonomic nervous system. And often when that is processed, released, let go, or opened up, there's like a release, and often there's more energy available. So it also, this process involves people. So it just, the process starts to stave off that loneliness and that isolation, because you need people to work through this. You can't do this on your own. But what's really great is that when that starts to get released or worked out or resolved or reconciled within oneself, there's a lot of energy available for the community, for hiking, for exercising, and it'll be like just a renewed interest. There's more room inside someone for life activities, whereas the addiction just takes up so much room.
All right. Kristen, thanks so much for the insights there.
It's an amazing process to see, and I just wanted to register here.
All right, and very well registered. Thanks for that, Kristen. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Kristen. In my practice, I'm dealing with the medical management of the opiates, but we absolutely encourage, push, cajole, ask people to get into therapy, right? Get into some counseling. There are 12-step programs and other programs that get people with people, so you're not isolated. But you absolutely need people such as yourself, Kristen, who can help people work through some of those underlying factors that are keeping them isolated or keeping them reaching for their substance of choice. So very, very important point. I'm so glad you called in.
There's something else, Dr. Thomas, that maybe you could comment on based on Kristen's call, which is that you say that a lot of times when your patients come in, they're afraid to taper down off of opioids because they're afraid they're going to be in more pain or they're going to have less energy, and that what you found in your practice is that the more you taper them down, the more they actually feel like they're getting a renewed lease on life, which is what Kristen was talking about.
Yeah, so Jennifer's speaking to a specific issue in the opioid part of addiction, which is largely what I'm dealing with in my practice. So many people come in, they're pain patients, or at least they feel like they are. They have become addicted to the opiates in their efforts to manage pain. And what happens is, when you start at a low dose, pretty soon it's not working as well as it used to, so you up your dose, and then that's not working as well as it used to. This is called tolerance. And the tolerance goes up and up and up until you're sort of maxed out. Your opioid receptors start recruiting new receptors. Now, opioid receptors are pain receptors, so you actually reach the point where you actually feel more pain because you've recruited so many opioid-like receptors. When I slowly wean people down off their opioids, almost every single person, and I've had hundreds, who were there for pain become amazed that their pain is actually less the lower the dose of opiates. But you have to sort of help them on that journey of gradually lowering the dose. Otherwise, they'll just take extra thinking it's going to help, and they go back into those old patterns of reinforcing, oh, if I've got pain, I need opioids. So that's also part of the journey, but the counseling and the addiction specialist treating, helping them work with their minds and their environment and all those factors are so important.
Let's get a little further into the chemistry here. We got just a taste of it right there, but I want to talk in particular about how opiates and opioids, the natural and the synthetic versions, do a really good job of mimicking the way that the brain experiences pleasure. And this is really one of the big things in addiction, isn't it?
Sure. Actually, almost any addictive substance is Boosting your dopamine, if you want to just pick on one neurotransmitter, it also involves boosting others. Alcohol boosts dopamine and GABA. We've got the marijuana THC with your cannabinoid system that was largely unknown until the 90s. And so the effect they have on your dopamine, just to pick that example, if it's methamphetamine, it's 100 times boost compared to, say, a less strong stimulant like food. So food will boost your dopamine a tiny bit.
And but you're getting a zoom. I mean, this is not just a bump. It's a skyrocket.
Right. Now, the cell phone example, this is the one that sneaks up on people. So a couple weeks ago, I had 6 new teenagers in one day come in depressed, suicidal, no focus, struggling to get out of bed to go to school. I mean, this was 6 in one day. It just blew my mind because typically I'll get 1 or 2 a week. And long story short, they all were spending 3 to 8 hours a day on their cell phones on school nights. This was on school days.
3 to 8 hours.
3 to 8 hours. Mm-hmm. So basically almost every spare moment. Think of the cell phone. And when I talk to people about reducing stress, I'll pull out my cell phone and show them this. I said, now when my alert goes off, my mind goes to it instantly. Why? I'm scanning for danger. We're animal kingdom creatures wired to scan for danger. And so that little alert on your phone or that swipe, or if you're playing video games, it's constant little danger responses. Now they add up because they're cumulative. If you're spending hours on that phone doing this, you might as well be taking methamphetamine. It's just you're taking little tiny doses that go dose, 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 dose until you wear out that neurotransmitter pathway. Now you feel this angst when you don't have it. So it's the same sort of withdrawal phenomenon that a meth addict or an alcoholic would get when they don't have their meth or their alcohol. Now you're getting a little minuscule withdrawal when you don't have your cell phone. So what do? You go back to it again. It's what Jennifer was alluding to earlier about the makers of these apps understanding that physiology, that they can keep you on there, and it's devastating. Now, there is a solution. I have to tell you this little story. 3 months ago, I had a 16-year-old come in with this same scenario. She had seen a psychiatrist. She was suicidal. She was on 2 antidepressants, and she was flat affect, what we call somebody who just, there are no facial expressions. And I knew her since she was a baby. She was always a very high-energy, happy kid. I was just floored. Long story short, I made a few recommendations about her food and her vitamins and rest and sleep and exercise and all these things. She left my office, had a concussion. She's a soccer player, and was actually knocked out unconscious. Went to the emergency room. They told her 1 month brain rest, no cell phones, no TV, no school, no friends. I mean, she was in trouble. She walks in a month later, 100% normal, happy.
The way you used to know her.
Bouncing off the chairs. That's when I really woke up. This story is not in our book, unfortunately, because we had already submitted the book by the time she came in. But she was cured. And what cured her? I started asking her. She was spending 7 or 8 hours a day on the phone. And when that access was removed, her brain could heal. I mean, she already had a good family as far as good nutrition and other things. So this was an example of, you know, basically detoxing from that constant stimulation of her cell phone and healing her brain. And I'm starting to see this more and more. Our kids today and young adults, and now it's actually us older adults, we're all struggling with too much time on our phones, not realizing the harm it's causing. It sneaks up on you, because at first it's just fun, right? And you don't realize that you're actually depleting your neurotransmitters.
Dr. Paul Thomas is an MD, board certified in pediatrics and addiction medicine. Jennifer Margulis is a hardworking, well-published, and award-winning journalist. They have put together a book called The Addiction Spectrum, A Compassionate, Holistic Approach to Recovery. So let's talk about the approach to recovery in the 6 or so minutes we got left here. You talk in the book about a failed conventional medical approach. What is medicine doing wrong that you are not doing in your approach?
Well, medicine is not dealing with this whole issue of supporting the entire organism, right? With nutrients, avoiding toxins, supporting the actual deficiencies. Our caller who found that he needed SAMe, everybody needs vitamin D. Often you need B12 or methylfolate, not regular folate. And then everybody's sleep deprived. Few are getting the enough exercise, and our biomes are depleted. Not to speak of the environment itself, the people you're around or not around, not being supportive of your journey. But to start your journey, if you're struggling with an addiction, you've got to do something. I tell the story of 3 frogs sitting on a log and one decides to jump off. How many are on the log? Well, there's Three. Making a decision doesn't change anything. You have to take the leap. Or the hound dog story. There's an old man sitting on his porch with his hound dog, and he's always howling and he's howling. The neighbor comes by. Why is your dog always howling? Well, he's sitting on a nail, he says. Well, why doesn't he get off the nail? I guess it doesn't hurt enough. Well, what's your nail, right? If you're struggling and you're suffering out there, you're sitting on a nail. Let's help you get off that nail and get on this journey of recovery. And there are people that can help you, and there are resources that can help you. The Addiction Spectrum book will at least give you an idea of some of the things you can do.
And you've got you've touched on most of these already, the 7-point action plan. Real food, less stress, vitamin D, exercise, good sleep, the gut microbiome you touched on as well, but connectedness with other people as well.
Yes.
But there's also, when you get into treating people with very severe specific addictions to drugs, you're a big fan of buprenorphine?
So for the opioid addict, if you try to go cold turkey, and this is what treatment centers used to do, and most of them have gone away from this for the following reason. We can put you in lockdown and force you to go through withdrawal. And yeah, you will go through the most horrendous withdrawal for a few days with, you know, shivers and shakes and vomiting and abdominal distress. And it is absolutely horrible. And then at the end of those few days, now you're detoxed, and they would say, okay, you're done. If it's a 7-day program, they release you right at that point. The problem is you're left so anxious, the amount of anxiety and angst you have and the low energy you feel, because remember, those neurotransmitters were being artificially supported for so long. Now they're like, bam, they crash. It takes months, depending on how much you were using for how long, it could even take a year or two before your neurotransmitters heal. And if you leave that person that raw and you send them, well, go out, good luck, go to some meetings or see a therapist, they're going to relapse almost instantly. And I saw that over and over again. So what we're doing now, there are two basic theories of what to do with an opioid addict. One is the harm reduction model. And this is the one that's popular. And I think it's maybe possibly because pharmaceutical companies support it. Harm reduction means you're going to take maximum doses of methadone or buprenorphine, and we're just going to keep your receptors flooded. And it's basically for life. So if we keep your receptors flooded with opiates, you won't go use because there's no point. If you go shoot up heroin or you take extra pills, it does absolutely nothing. Those receptors are already flooded. So we are reducing harm. You're not going to go out and spread HIV or Hep C or share needles because there's no point. The receptors are full. But that's not a life. I mean, most people who are on high opioids, whether they're methadone or heroin or whatever, it's not a full, vibrant, healthy life. You're just loaded. So I propose a different model of very careful, slow weaning of your opioids with buprenorphine. The power of buprenorphine is that it's partial agonist, meaning it gives you part opiate effect, so you don't go through withdrawal, but it's also a powerful antagonist. It blocks the opioid receptors. So if you do happen to go out and use, there's not any point. And so that gives that person time to start building life skills, to start eating better, to start developing a supportive community, all the things we talk about in the book. And so it seems to be fairly effective.
Jennifer Margulis, with all the trends you have covered in life, health, and medicine, I wonder if even you have been surprised at how many people seem to be showing up with addictions these days. That's the first part of the question. The second part of the question is, based on what you've researched, are there enough resources out there to handle all the people who need help right now?
Yeah, those are excellent questions. You know, I think that the trend towards, we talk about addiction as a chronic condition. And what I think surprised me a lot, looking at the numbers are staggering and they're kind of meaningless. I mean, you have to sort of compare them to something in order to understand when we talk about the
right, when it's like more than a stadium full of people, it's really hard to comprehend.
Yeah, or like three times the population of Ashland, Oregon, you know, and I mean, when you look at places that are really hit hard with addiction, you're seeing that so many people are also dying of overdoses, which is really disturbing. But part of it has to, in terms of connecting the dots, we're seeing children and adults with so many chronic diseases, with autoimmune issues, chronic problems, things
allergies.
Like allergies, asthma, type 1 diabetes, that kind of thing. And so this addiction crisis, I appreciate how much the mainstream media is talking about addiction now. And I think we also have to talk about it in the context of our health in general, which seems to be going in the wrong direction.
All right, a lot of work left ahead and a lot to read about in the book. It's really interesting stuff. It's called The Addiction Spectrum, A Compassionate, Holistic Approach to Recovery, the work of Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis. And, of course, they have that conference coming up tomorrow on healthy immunity at Southern Oregon University at Stevenson Union. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Always good to have you in the studio together.